amplifier votre passion pour la guitare pour quelques euros par mois. Rendez-vous sur lachaîneguitare.com. Amplify your passion for the guitar for a few dollars per month. Head over to theguitarchannel.biz. Welcome to the Guitar Channel. I am super happy to welcome you a new interview. I have on the other side of the Skype connection the one and only JD Simo. JD, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you doing? It's good to see you again.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. So last time we met, I think it was, I believe, in 2017. You were in Paris at the time. It was for the release of Rise and Shine, right?
Yeah.
What's up since then? So it's been too long, JD.
It has been too long. I mean, we, you know, a lot of touring and, you know, much like everybody else, you know, ground to a halt earlier this year. And, you know, there's been positive aspects to it as well as negative. You know, it's much like most things in life, you know, there's yin to the yang.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, just continued lots of, you know, since I saw you last, tons of touring, made my first solo record, which came out about, I guess, a year and a half ago now, which was followed by a bunch of touring. And then I started playing in 2018. I started playing some with Phil Lesh from the Grateful Dead and worked on a bunch of a lot of fun stuff, worked on a lot of cool, you know, started producing some other artists and a lot of other collaborations and working on movie soundtracks for people and stuff. It's been really, you know, I'm in the middle of working on a movie soundtrack for this Tom Hanks Elvis biopic that's coming out next year.
Very cool.
Which has been really, really fun. So, you know, mm-hmm. More just living, buying records, you know, drinking good coffee, you know.
Excellent. Tell us about how you approach composing music for a movie compared to the record we're going to talk about in a minute. Is that very different?
It is. It's very, I mean, when you're working, it's any time you're doing something that isn't for yourself, you're trying to please someone else's vision, you know, whether it's if you're working on a film or working on television stuff, which I've done a lot of, especially this year, you know, the director has a specific vision of what they're looking for, what they want. And so working within that parameter, which, you know, when I'm working on my own stuff, it's just to please myself. So yeah, that's the biggest difference,
mm-hmm.
you know, but I'm lucky that, you know, the majority of the projects that I'm involved with are all kind of within the realm of stuff that I really love and dig. So, you know, for example, like working on this Baz Luhrmann, Tom Hanks, Elvis movie, you know, the research for a lot of the music in the film is stuff that I already love, whether it's obviously Elvis music, but it's, you know, also we did a bunch of Sister Rosetta Thorpe. We did a bunch of, you know, like Big Joe Williams kind of stuff. There's a lot of period music in the film, which I love. Muddy Waters. There's Big Boy Crudup, all that kind of stuff. And so it's and country music as well. So I really, you know, that, you know, you don't have to. You mean you're gonna pay me to have some fun and do this? That sounds good, you know. So I'm lucky in that regard. You know, I'm not really working on anything that is outside the realm of what I think is cool. You know, mm-hmm. so that's a blessing.
Mm-hmm. What was the direct impact of the situation we are going through at the moment? You just mentioned that there were some positive and negative aspect. I suppose there were many dates canceled for your touring schedule.
Yeah, I mean, that was the main thing, is that for, you know, since 2015 or so, you know, I've, you know, easily done 150 or more shows a year, which has kept me on the road over 200 days a year. And, you know, for that to completely stop was obviously a gigantic change in my life. But the positive aspect of it is, I was fortunate that I kind of pivoted very, very quickly, started doing live stream stuff very quickly, started, you know, reaching out through social media to my peers in a way that I had never fully taken full advantage of. And as a result of it, I've been involved, like doing tracks and doing collaborative, you know, things for limited release, or sometimes just for YouTube content or something, with, you know, a huge host of my friends here in the States and abroad as well, that I never would have had the time to, or never would have had the notion to. And I feel in a lot of ways a lot closer to my peer group than I ever have as a result of that. And also, you know, I have a young daughter now. She's almost 2 years old, and my wife and I, you know, to be home and only working in my studio downstairs, working on stuff for films or working on stuff for my own content for live streams and for other stuff. It's just been a wonderful balance for me. And luckily it's all, you know, like I said, I was able to pivot relatively quickly, but it's been a lovely little break from, you know, a really kind of, you know, chaotic many, many years of just, you know, no real recovery time, just long tours followed by a short, you know, I don't know, at times, you know, sometimes only a couple of days of break, sometimes at the most, maybe 2 or 3 weeks, not really long enough to kind of get in a routine or really kind of have any sense of grounding. And, you know, it's been, for the most part, it's been really wonderful. Mm-hmm. And, that's starting to change now as things start to evolve of how to kind of move forward and safely be able to play live music for people again. And I'm really fortunate that the people that I work with, like my management and my agents and the people from my record label and stuff, we all share the same ideals of what is important with that, because obviously there's quite a divide in my country, mm-hmm. to put it mildly, mm-hmm. as to
we heard about it, yes.
yes. of how to deal with that. And you know, it's incredibly important, it's direly important, to be on the right side of the force with all of this.
Tell us about how it felt to play, to do live broadcast, and how does it feel to play without an audience, especially for you, who is a very energetic player, and you put a lot of energy in your stage when you are on stage. So how does it felt?
It's been a huge adjustment, but like most things, I've gotten used to it. Over time, over the last 6 months, I mean, I've done so much of it that, you know, it's like anything. You adjust and you learn how to try and make each one a little better, how mm-hmm. to get more and more comfortable. But that being said, you know, we did last week, we did our first full band private show. We've started this thing where essentially groups of about 15 fans will get together and get a location secured, and we can go do a socially distant private show, and with a whole bunch of guidelines and obviously all masked up and other precautions as well. And I mean, that just felt, I mean, it felt like my first show ever in my life. Like, okay. It was so great. just with a handful of people, mm-hmm. it's amazing that it's like, it really is like, it doesn't take thousands of people to feel that feeling. And it's been great. And actually, just 2 nights ago, I did my first out of town show here in America. I went to Tulsa, Oklahoma, to the historic Kane's Ballroom. For a ticketed live stream show, which had a very limited audience. I mean, there was like 50 people in a place that holds 2,000 people. So it was like, you know, and that was wonderful as well. Mm-hmm. So even if it's a tiny, tiny audience, it still feels really good, you know. But that being said, I mean, it's I'm happy to adapt, you know, for the sake of people's health and my own health. And also, you know, just trying to be a good example, you know. I don't have to tell you that it's, you know, it's not that hard to put a mask on and yeah. It's really not that hard.
Yeah.
It's really not that difficult. It's really not that difficult. And it's, you know, I'm a strong believer in science.
That's a good thing, yeah. I am with you on that for sure. Let's talk about the self-titled album, J.D. Simo. The color is definitely more soul music than blues. Was that a conscious decision from your end?
Not necessarily. It's just what I was writing, you know. It's an evolution of where I'm at. And it's amazing to me how, I mean, we made the record in January, and I can't believe how pertinent and how relevant a lot of the things that I was writing about is, you know, obviously relevant to the heavy times that we're in. Obviously, that could not have been planned, but I feel really good about the lyrical content in regards to the times we're in, because I feel it's really important right now more than ever that if you're going to be putting stuff out into the world, it's anything that even remotely resembles business as usual or something is not appropriate. It that's how I feel, at least, you know. I think it's really it's never been more important. Mm-hmm. Especially in this country.
Do you usually compose music and lyrics at the same time? Do you have a specific method? How do you usually work?
I generally knock things out in one swoop. Usually the music comes first, generally, but I write the words right away. A lot of the time I compose with the drummer, Adam Abershoff. Most of the time we will get together and work on something and sort of compose the structure of the song. And then I'll take a break and go write the words, because I'll sing, I'll be singing kind of nonsense to find what the melody is. And I've at least found with myself that if I sort of put it aside and say, I'll come back to it and I'll write lyrics later, either they're not good or I don't. And if I take a break while we're in the middle of it and I go off into a room, I usually can figure out what it is that I'm like trying to say relatively quickly. Like in the nonsense I'm singing, I can kind of figure out what it is that I'm trying to say. And usually it comes fairly quick, you know, but that's generally how I write most of the time.
How was the album recorded? Because when we listen to it, there is a very raw aspect to it. So was it recorded like, okay, everybody in the room, but and still in many places in the album, there are a lot of guitars and background vocals and everything. So what was your method?
Well, we recorded over a few days at a studio here in Nashville that I love a lot, Sound Emporium, which it's my favorite studio in town. And yeah, it was all, everything's cut live to tape. And we, you know, I like to work very linear, meaning that we cut the track and any overdubs and the vocal, if I wasn't singing the vocal live, I do right then before we move on. I don't like to leave a bunch of stuff till later. I like to, when I'm in the middle of working on a track, I finish it before I move on. Because for some reason, when I listen to music, when I listen to other people's music, a lot of times I can hear, I can sense that it's fragmented. It's like, oh, they sang that 2 weeks later. Mm-hmm. Like I can sort of feel that sometimes. But yeah, it was all cut in the moment, relatively, And any of the kind of sonic craziness, because we did a lot of abuse of studio gear, messing with tape machines and like on Anna Lee for example is that's all. None of that is like Pro Tools or anything. That's all, you know, like manual messing with a tape machine, and that was really fun, you know, to have the opportunity to mess around with old gear and hopefully not break it.
Yeah. What did you use as for regarding guitars? Did you use Old Red for the album?
Pretty much the whole time I used my 335, and I also used an old ES5, like T-Bone Walker used to play the three pickup fat.
Nice.
ES5, which actually the next time I'm in Paris, I hear T-Bone's ES5 is in Paris.
It
and
is, yes.
I very much look forward to seeing that. But I've got one of those that I think it's from 1952 that I used on some stuff. And then I have an old Fender Jazzmaster that I keep tuned down to B, like a baritone guitar. And I use that on Soul of a Man and Help. Those are the guitars, at least. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Was there a project at one time that Gibson would release a signature model based on Old Red, or did it happen? Or
it happened in a very limited capacity. They did like they were super expensive, and they were like, you know, highly aged, like every nick on the guitar kind of thing. And I mean, we've discussed doing another like non-aged, like normal production. We've been talking about that for the last couple of years, and you know, it may or may not come to fruition. They've been very kind to the new Caesar and JC, the new CEO and CFO of the company, have been really, really kind to me and really nice. And I still have a lot of friends over there, so we'll see. But yeah, it was really cool. I have the prototypes, and it's pretty funny because the old one, you have to understand that like the old one continues to become more and more beat up.
Yeah.
So like they
have to readjust everything.
the ones that I have from when they did it, like it already doesn't look like the guitar anymore, because it's like the real one has become that much more beat up, you know.
Mm-hmm. But you were happy about the result, the end result of the guitar they built was very close to Old Red, yeah.
Mm. Oh, sure, yeah. And what an honor, you know. I mean, I was in my 20s before I could even afford a real Gibson, you know. So to have a Gibson with my name on it was like, geez, are you serious? let me pay you.
I remember in 2015 when we did our first interview, it was on stage right before a concert you did here in Paris, and you were playing a true vintage Sunburst, a 59 or 60, I don't remember, which was, I think, a loan from a collector. Are you still playing that guitar?
No, I gave it back. I gave it back a few years ago. I mean, I had a lot of fun with that instrument, and it sort of got to a point where I had that guitar for a couple of years, and the thrill of playing something that valuable sort of faded away, and it became an instrument.
Mm-hmm.
The sort of you can kind of get used to anything. Not that I was not precious with it and took care of it, but I'm just saying that it's like at the end of the day, it's an instrument. It's a guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And I when it came down to it, I preferred my old 335. And so when several months went by and I hadn't really used it, I was like, well, you know, I'm just going to give this back, because mm-hmm. obviously I'm not using it. And the person was kind enough to loan it to me to use. And so that whole thing taught me a really important lesson, you know, that it really, you know, an instrument is an instrument, and it should you should play something that's comfortable to you, and what it is really doesn't matter much. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's been a very freeing experience for me, because obviously if I didn't have you know, insane collector friends that give me the opportunity to experience these kind of instruments, I wouldn't have that kind of revelation. Mm-hmm. You know, it's been a really good lesson for me in kind of materialism. Mm-hmm. If that makes sense. Mm-hmm.
I remember when we did the interview, because during the interview we talked about many things, about music and about the guitar, and at the end of the interview you took the guitar and you put it over my neck, and I was kind of scared, you know, to move around, because I had a real Les Paul sunburst around my neck, but everything went fine and I didn't break anything, thank God. So
absolutely. Yeah, man, you know. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting thing. Jimmy Vaughn has a really great, he said something really pertinent one time, where he was like, man, he's like, all of our heroes walked into a pawn shop and said, man, I'll take the red one. And then they took it and went and did their thing. You know, there's a really, there's an important kind of thing in it that's kind of lost, you know. Mm-hmm. It's the, you know, find something that's comfortable to you. It doesn't have to be something intrinsically expensive, and create, you know, because what you do with it is what really matters. Mm-hmm. You know?
What about other tone toys you use on the record? Pedals, amps?
I've really gotten into old Ampeg amps as of late. I really, through the folks over at Daptone, Gabe Roth and Tommy Brennick, and, you know, the guys from the Dap Kings and stuff, I got really turned on to Ampeg Gemini amps, which is sort of Ampeg's version of a Blackface Fender. And they're really cheap. At least over here in America, I mean, like $300-$400. I mean, they're really cheap. Nobody knows about them, and I got really into those. And so I've got a couple of those, and those are my favorite. I've pretty much switched completely over to those. And I also, there's a little Tweed. There's a company in Texas in the '40s that made amplifiers called Alamo amps, and those are really cheap too if you can find them. And they're better than a Fender Tweed, in my opinion. And so those are the main things that I use amplifier-wise on the record. Effects-wise, I have this old 70s Japanese fuzz wah, and it's made by a company called Jax, J-A-X. And it's got a fuzz tone in it that sounds a lot like Michael Tolles and who played with Isaac Hayes, and it's a real fizzy kind of R&B kind of fuzz tone, and I love the wah-wah in it. So I use that, and then I also have an original, I guess it's like a 72 or so fuzz face that I use all the time. I love that thing. I found a really good one that does exactly what I want, and so those are the two main effects. And then tape echo of some sort, usually a Benson, an old Benson Echo Rec, or an Echoplex of some sort. Live, I really like the Strymon El Capistan. I think that's really a good, it really does sound a lot, especially if you take the time to, a good friend of mine early on in the pandemic, told me about the secondary functions on the El Capistan, where you can really set the parameters of it, you know, deeply. And he had some settings that he had taken a long time to kind of tweak to make it sound really authentic. And I took the time to do that. And it was, I'm actually pretty surprised at how great that unit is. There's a couple times on the record where I use a Vibe, like a Univibe pedal. And there's this guy here in America called Rick Reaver, who's making these really great clones. It's called the Violet Vibe. And it's a guy in upstate New York who makes a really good one. And I use that on a couple of tracks. And everything else is all like everything other than those parameters is all like studio effects, outboard gear. And then on Anna Lee, I should say, Anna Lee, I'm actually playing through an old Casio boombox. I'm not actually playing through an amp.
Okay.
We recorded Anna Lee on one microphone, and I was playing through this old boombox that also had a drum machine in it. And it was just a really cool, funky sound, and Adam was playing drums on the trash cans in the studio. And what afforded us to be the reason why there's this, you know, left side, right side thing on that track is it's actually two different takes, but because there's the drum machine coming from the boombox, they're both at the same tempo. So it's actually two different takes. It's not a delay or anything. It's two takes that kind of like zip around, and, you know, we had some fun on that one. That was a really fun track to work on.
As we are still in the middle of the pandemic all over the world, so what are you going to do to promote the album? Obviously, you're going to do remote interviews like we are doing, but anything special?
Yeah, I mean, I'm obviously doing a lot of Zoom and Skype interviews and performances, and now starting to do a lot more ticketed live stream shows that are like pro shot, and we have several coming up. And yeah, I mean, that's about all I can do at the moment. And I do the weekly Greasy Time live stream show where I feature different people's records every week. And I've released a new track every week of the pandemic. So this week, tomorrow night will be the 23rd episode. So just trying to continue to put things that I've put effort into out into the world. You know, I obviously we all are in the same boat. We look forward to when things can progress, but I also am in no hurry to do so. I think that, you know, this is this is a time for us to really contemplate the things that are really important, and we're afforded this amazing opportunity to kind of restart and rebuild from a true perspective of, you know, not trying to repeat mistakes maybe we've made in the past. I'm not saying that we're going to accomplish all these things, but that's the opportunity that's afforded us, and I certainly in my own life look forward to continuing down that path. Mm-hmm. And you know, I surely, you know, live in hope that that the goodness of humanity can prevail.
Let's hope. Yeah, let's hope for sure. Yeah. So if people want to buy a ticket for your online performance, they do what? They go to your website? How can we do that?
The social media sites are the absolute best way to stay up to date with me. My Facebook and Instagram and Twitter, all of them are under the moniker JD Simo Music, because there's updates daily on those. And I mean, people can go to the website as well, but for, you know, all of the latest stuff, the social platforms are the best. And you know, there's really great merch bundles with vinyl and so on and so forth on our Bandcamp site. Bandcamp has been a hugely, hugely supportive platform to independent artists, independent labels. They're fighting the good fight as far as coming up with software advancements and ways to help artists through this process. And they're doing it in a very humanely fair situation, not seizing the opportunity by any means to benefit themselves. So I very much support the Bandcamp platform. They're really they've really, really proven time and time again through this whole process. And so I've actually switched all of my merch. I've switched all of my merch and stuff over to Bandcamp because it's just so great.
Yeah.
So just Google JD Simo Bandcamp and it'll take you there.
Yeah,
so,
I see that more and more group bands and musicians are moving to Bandcamp and are really happy about that. So that's good to know. You are based in Nashville. Tell me a little bit more about the music scene in Nashville. I've been there, but it was like a lifetime ago in the past century. So hopefully I have some plan in the future to go to Nashville as a journalist for the Guitar Channel. What should I go? Where should I go? What should I expect in Nashville?
Well, I mean, it's a very tight knit community. It's we've obviously, you know, hunkered down quite a bit, and we've had, you know, in addition to the pandemic, we had a horrible host of tornadoes that ravaged our town. So we've had a rough one. But as far as the community is concerned, it's a very artistic, very, for the most part, progressive community. And there's, if you love vinyl and record shops, we have some of the best in the country.
Mm-hmm.
If you like good coffee, I mean, obviously, you know, I can't say that we even come close to the level of caffeine I've ingested in Paris, but we have some of the best coffee roasters as well, at least in our region. And as far as music stores are concerned, with Carter Vintage,
yeah,
and Rumble Seat Music and mm-hmm. Groom mm-hmm. Guitars, all literally within a mile and a half of each other, I don't think there's another place on the planet where one could experience more historical instruments for certain. But also a wide range, more options than one could ever hope for. Like no matter what it is you're looking for, if you're looking for something insanely expensive or looking for working man's equipment, we are so spoiled here. It's absolutely incredible. So that's definitely a must. And we have, you know, I would say, you know, for our region, some of the best, you know, local food as well. I mean, we've really grown as far as a very progressive city for our region, obviously being in the South. And it's a beautiful place. It's definitely home. I was born and raised in Chicago, Illinois, and I never in a million years thought I would ever live in the South. And this has really become home for me. And it's the community of professional great artists. Luckily, all of the great venues have banded together to try and help one another through this situation. I think of places like the Station Inn, which is one of the most legendary bluegrass venues in the world. Small venues like the Five Spot, which is a kind of a community center on the east side of town. East Nashville is sort of a even more clustered, you know, I would say probably the east side of town is more influenced by European culture. It's a nice little neighborhood of art. So, I mean, there's a lot to do, mm-hmm. you know, there's a lot of independent businesses, that are obviously trying to hang on. It's a very soulful place, you know,
yeah.
I love it here.
I really hope when it's going to be possible to travel again to the US to plan a trip to Nashville, and you will be my guide, right?
I would love to. Yeah. I would love to actually take you around. I'm a good guide.
One of the good things of the pandemic, which came out of the pandemic, is that a musician that you surely know, who is named Tom Bukovac, started yeah. his YouTube show, and I never heard about him before, and I am a big fan of his what he's doing, and he's one of the top session men, right, in the Nashville
state,
right?
In the world, when I moved to Nashville in 2006, he was already, you know, the top call A-team session guitars playing on everything. And he's just remained there. And Tom and I are very good friends and known each other for a long time and played a lot of poker against
Okay.
each other. And
And you're still
he's
friends.
a oh yeah. No, he's a wonderful rascal. And it's been very, very entertaining as a friend of his to see this whole thing because you have to understand Tom for the entire time I've known him, he's shied away from anything even remotely public. He's classically even said no to interviews and guitar magazines and blogs and all this kind of stuff. He's always very happily kind of remained in the shadows, and it's hilarious to me to see that he's become a YouTube star, because that is the opposite of the man that I've known for 15 years, but it's a good example of someone who obviously has a lot a lifetime's worth of experience to share, let alone his talent. But I mean, he's a very smart man who has been through a myriad of life, of life experiences in the music business. And for his own sanity, I mean, it legitimately was, in the beginning, it was him doing something for his own sanity. And it just naturally found an audience and has become this thing. And it's beautiful because that's, in the end, that's what you want. I think that one thing that I've seen, at least with looking at my own, and I'm sure that you're probably in the same boat, looking at my own analytics of what type of content gets the most views, the most likes, the most connection to audience are the ones that aren't trying to sell something, that aren't trying to do anything except share something that is authentic. And that has been a really interesting and very kind of oh, thank God, in regards to seeing at least, what limited view I have of what people are liking from me, that, it's like if I'm any time I've ever sort of even remotely tried to do something to, that would resemble a commercial of some sort, it just doesn't have nearly the amount of connection and views and likes and shares and stuff like that than the things where I'm just talking and doing something that I really think is great. And Tom is in the same boat where it's just he's sharing what he's got to say and do that morning, and it's a beautiful thing. It's
Yeah,
very organic.
it is definitely. As a conclusion, what would be your word of wisdom you would like to share with people to so they can have the same kind of level of energy you are showing here on the video? So, what do you smoke, Jedi? What do
You
you
know what I
drink? We want
smoke.
to know.
You know what I smoke. You know what I smoke. No, just wear a damn mask. I don't have to say it to the to people over there, but no, just I think it's important to get up every day with a certain level of gratitude. I like to do a daily gratitude list of things that I dig, and I listen to music voraciously every day. I try and listen to at least a record or two every day that I have not listened to before, which I think is really important.
What is your latest discovery on
My
music?
latest, well, there's, oh man, I could talk to you for hours about this, Pierre, but no, just in the last 24 hours, I actually discovered, just on the drive back from Tulsa, I found there's a small little label that existed for less than a year in the early 60s. And I really like Magic Sam a lot, who from Chicago, blues guy in the 50s and 60s. And he recorded for Cobra in the 50s, and then he recorded for Del Mar in the 60s. And there was a set of recordings only like three songs that I could find, but he recorded for this label Crash Records in the early 60s, apparently. And I'd never heard this stuff, and I just found it yesterday. And, you know, that was a really, really good find, as far as something that I didn't know existed. And the other thing is Cannonball Adderley, this is another thing in the last 2 days, Cannonball Adderley, the famous saxophone player from the 60s, I had no idea that he had teamed up with David Axelrod, who I love a lot. He made those really amazing psychedelic sort of soundtrack-esque type of records in the late 60s in Los Angeles. And Song of Innocence is one of my favorite albums, and that's one of Axelrod's finest works. And I didn't know that him and Cannonball Adderley had actually worked together. And there's a wonderful collection on Spotify that was just released a few years ago of everything they did together. And they cut like maybe 30 or 40 different tracks. And it's beautiful because it's Cannonball, who's this beautiful bop saxophonist, and Axelrod, who had this very kind of cinematic, psychedelic undertone to him. And so those two things together makes for a really, really fascinating and just destructively cool thing. So that's something that I found just in the last 2 days. And yeah, I could go on and on, but those are two things from the last 48 hours.
Okay, excellent. JD, I have to thank you very much for your time. It is always a pleasure to do an interview with you. Hopefully next time you will be in Paris, here right next to me in my showroom, and we will do a guitar in hand interview. Okay, deal?
I'm all about it. I'm all about it.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah,
no, thank you for having me.
It is a pleasure, and congratulations for the release of the album, because it is great music. So thank you very much for your time, and I wish you all the best for the rest of the adventure. Thank you, JD.
You as well.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Pour le prix d'un magazine, abonnez-vous à la chaîne Guitare pour accéder aux vidéos intégrales. For the price of a magazine, subscribe to the Guitar Channel to access the full videos.